honey, be before the, yeah. Be for the honey, be before the.
I'm Roxy Power with the Hive Poetry Collective at KSQD 90.7 FM Santa Cruz. At the Hive, we bring you all kinds of poetry for all kinds of people. You can tune in Sunday nights, 8 p.m., or listen to us at ksqd.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also look at our events at hivepoetry.org because Hive Live organizes events at the Bookshop Santa Cruz about every other month, such as the California Poet Laureate Lee Herrick and Dorianne Locks last week, and coming up on April 26th at Cabrillo College in celebration of the Muse. I'm very honored to be with my good friend, Paul Nelson, and fantastic poet. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Roxy.
Paul E. Nelson, who's the son of a labor activist father and Cuban immigrant mother. Born on Chicago's West Side in 1961, he's lived in King County, Washington since 1988. He founded the Cascadia Poetics Lab, which I love. I've taken so many classes there, and the Cascadia Poetry Festival, which I equally love. I just attended it last year. Since 1993, CPL has produced hundreds of poetry events and 700 hours of interview programming with legendary poets and whole systems activists, including Allen Ginsberg, Michael McClure, Joanne Kiger, Robin Blazer, Diane DePrima, Nate Mackey, Brenda Hillman, and countless others.
Among Paul's many books are Cascadian Prophets, Interviews 1999 to 2023, published this past February, Haibun de la Serna, published in 2022, A Time Before Slaughter, Pig War, and Other Songs of Cascadia, 2020, American Prophets, Interviews 1994 to 2012, published in 2018, American Sentences, 2015 and 2021. And he's the co-editor of Cascadian Zen Volume 1, Bioregional Writings on Cascadia Here and Now in 2023, Watershed Press. That's an amazing book. Make It True meets Medusario, 2019, Spanish and English and other anthologies. He's literary executor for the late poet Sam Hamill and lives in Rainier Beach. And this spring, his newest book, Day Song Miracle, Past 62, is coming out from Carbonation Press.
Now that I've mentioned the word day song three times, I think we probably need to orient our listeners to what the heck a day song is, because that's one of the things we're going to be spending our time talking about today. You do these marathon writing sessions across the course of a day, which takes a lot of what you call poetic musculature to get through, and which takes many years of daily practices, writing what you do every day, American sentences, which are kind of like a haiku, 17 syllables. Allen Ginsberg made them famous. And you write in your journal and you always do these big investigative poetics projects, usually focused on bioregional poetry, such as in Cascadia, such as A Time Before Slaughter and Pig War. So you've got your poetic muscle kind of going all the time so that you can wake up at 5-something in the morning and start writing. So why don't you just tell our listeners a little bit about what a day song is and why you like to write so many of them.
Thanks for this opportunity, Roxy. A delight to talk to you in this way, and I'm very grateful. My personal website, paulenelson.com, has a lot about my personal stuff, and cascadiapoeticslab.org is the website of the organization. I founded in 1993. The day song came out of the writing workshops, which I started online when the COVID lockdown was happening. We couldn't be in person. Everything moved to Zoom, and it was recommended I start facilitating workshops to expound on the projective slash organic slash practice of outside poetics that I've been studying really since 1995, when I met Michael McClure and interviewed him. And he said, if you like what I'm doing, it's because you like the method, which is projective verse, get the essay, read it out loud. It was written by Charles Olson, published in 1950, and he wrote it in a style emulating Ezra Pound. So a little pedantic, a little difficult, but read it out loud and you'll begin to get it more directly. And it took me a long time to get it. And I don't fully get everything that Charles Olson was saying, but writing projectively seemed to resonate with what I was already doing at that time without knowing it. And so we started doing these workshops that have come to be known as Poetics as Cosmology and Life as Rehearsal for the Poem, which comes out of a line from Eileen Miles, who was a guest at our old SPLAB in Auburn, Washington, I think in around the year 2000. She talks about hunting the poem and going out, feeling electric, and the life she was living was a rehearsal for the moment when she was writing a poem. Resonates very much with our poetics. And so going after the examples of Bernadette Mayer, Midwinter Day, and Pierre Joris, Canto Diurno, both of them written, well, Bernadette, 1988, Winter Solstice, and Canto Diurno, 1980 or 81. And we started doing this as a ritual. Michael McClure told me he does little rituals for himself. And I love that notion. I use it in my spiritual ecology practice. And so I thought, after a summer of writing poetry postcards, which is our Poetry Postcard Fest, 56 days of August, you've got between the 4th of July and the end of August to write 31 original poems on a postcard. And you have this spatial restriction of how many lines can you fit in? 12 to 14. Nashira Priest are more like 36, but she wrote all over the card, bless her soul. And so at the end of that, it's a chance to exercise your long distance poetry muscles. And so rather than a spatial restriction, try a temporal restriction. And I organized three of these events, writing exercises, and I've done four myself. And it's liberating. It's fantastic. And, you know, like this kind of poetry, it's an act of discovery. And so I'm writing, you know, what did William Carlos Williams say? Something about, you know, I write to learn what I think. He also said something I've never been able to find the direct quote, but Barry McKinnon, rest his soul, said that William Carlos Williams believed that each poem you write should be a summation of your life up to that point. And so I think those two Williams quotes are applicable. And of course, he being one of the exemplars of projective verse, according to Charles Olson.
Well, it is true that a lot of those folks in the 50s were writing these manifestos about, you know, whether or not it's Frank O'Hara going on your nerve, which was a kind of parodic send-up of Olson's projective verse. But it really, you know, one thought must lead directly and instantly to another thought at the speed of speech. See people like Olson and Ginsberg, who you've also cited as a great influence on you, writing long and writing fast. And then there's the other kind of writing from the moment of composition in a way that is very process oriented, but much more mystical, more spiritual, slower in some ways. I think of Denise Levertov, whose Notes on Organic Form is what comes to mind when I think of you the most, because I was in a group called the Poetry Junkies, and someone said after I gave a presentation on that essay, oh my God, you have to know Paul Nelson. He's Mr. Organic Poetry. His classes, Poetry as Cosmology, are really based on Levertov. And I can't come to know you, of course, as Mr. Poetry of Seattle. You do absolutely everything there. But this idea of poetry as, you know, revelation of content rather than extension of content, in a way, relies on the poem incubating in you spiritually for a while. So I'm interested in that incubation period, as Levertov discussed it, and in which you and Veronica Martinez, I think, talk about in an interview at the end of your forthcoming book, that if the poem comes out too soon, according to Levertov, it's not ready, it's not cooked.
But at the same time, you don't want an overcooked poem. And that's why I think that you very much turn to jazz and spontaneous composition practices that are very much aligned with improvisation. Of course, jazz musicians have to know the form of the song once it's their turn to deliver their 8 to 16 measures of improvisation. They must know the song first. So you know what you're doing before you go into the day song. You've been thinking about your message, your intention. You've been practicing your scales, so to speak. And you've done a lot of reading of serial poems by Nate Mackey, Robin Blazer, and others, and you have in mind what you want to do before you set forth on the day song. So how do you prepare to write one?
The original day song was designed as something to do after the Poetry Postcard Fest. So having written at least 31 poems, and usually I write about 40 during postcard season, here's an opportunity to stretch out, as I said before. And Levertov said it was a friendly amendment to Creeley's form is never more than an extension of content, when she said form is never more than a revelation of content. And I think that's more accurate. You know, the form and the content are really being discovered at the same moment. And that does not preclude parts or whole aspects of quote-unquote formal poetry, inherited forms, as Duncan was quick to note about composition by field, where there's room for everything in the field. Another thing that Michael McClure said was that I get writer's block about 6 or 7 times a day, which is, you know, kind of a ironic way of saying that you get stopped for a moment, but then, you know, there's an impulse that comes. And he did a lot of what he called grafting. So taking a line from someone else and writing from that. And, you know, if you write 40 postcard poems in a July, August period, and you get stuck during the day song, you can simply go back to that and see what postcard poems you had still have something to say about it, which has a lot to do with serial form and the way that Nate Mackey talks about it and the way that Robin Blazer talked about it. I think you can go back to themes over and over again and find that you weren't definitive, that you left it open, and that there's more to say about it, and especially as time goes by, because you've had experiences that you can draw on that help you to understand there was more to that particular experience than I knew at the time. So you know, here's what comes out. And, you know, it's what comes out is maybe a chapter of the day song, maybe a 90-minute period between lunch and a coffee break or a bathroom break or whatever for you to do your things. So those are some of my responses.
Yeah, it's very quotidian in a way. You're documenting the times. You know, you start at 5:38 a.m. or whatever, and then you'll document 7:38 breakfast break, which really kind of puts me in mind of Ed Sanders' documentary investigative poetics and documentary poetics and saturation poetics, things that we've talked about a lot in your classes. That, you know, you have a lifelong project that you want to investigate in bits and pieces, and often you'll do it at a year at a time. Like one of yours was 1980. This most recent one was this last year when you turned 62. Three of your friends, alas, had died at the age of 62. So you're looking at mortality. But I did want to say before we get into, and I think our listeners are probably anxious to hear some of your poems. This one, in fact, the newest one. I want to say that the first thing that I noticed about your several books so far is that they tend to be written in very long form or very short form. But you've also published a book called American Sentences. We mentioned the Americanized version of a haiku, 17-syllable sentences. A lot of them are hilarious. In 2022, your Haibun de la Serna, 99 Neo-Barocco Haibun under the influence of Ramon Gomez de la Serna, who's famous, tell me if I pronounce this correctly, Gregarias?
Gregarias.
Okay.
Aphorisms. Yeah. Nothing forgets us as quickly as a bar stool. Is one example of
that. That's good. I love that one. Yeah, I think of them as short, comedic, and pithy. Three words I would apply to you. So here's an example from Paul's American Sentences. Auburn bumper sticker says, "The hell with rent. I'm getting a tattoo." And I opened with that one because we're going to return to Auburn and talk about that, because it used to be called Slaughter. And that is, you know, his pièce de résistance, a long book called A Time Before Slaughter. In A Time Before Slaughter. And here's another one. It occurs to me returning the book on voodoo's a good thing. Or next time for Airbnb, check prior review for head injuries. And all those sugar ants on that discarded watermelon rind, they're drunk. So yeah, you have a daily practice of writing one of these every day. And you also, in these haibun, which I find very lovely, and we've said a little bit about de la Serna, who was born in the mid-19th century, late 19th century, I guess.
Late 19th century, yeah.
Yeah, and was kind of affiliated with the Italian futurists, for better or worse. We all love the the way they write, but yeah, some problematic kind of political affiliations, but really comedic and funny. Why don't we just get into some of your poetry instead of just talking about it? I was hoping that you could maybe, before we have you read the first few pages of your newest book, why, if you agree with me, that you have this attraction to writing kind of very short or very long?
Well, I guess the way that's the way it goes. I think a poet ought to have a range, and the daily practice of writing a 17-syllable poem is very, very short. When Andrew Schelling and Ann Waldman were in my studio in Auburn talking about mm-hmm. Allen and participating in the Allen Ginsberg Memorial Open Mic Poetry Marathon. Mm-hmm. They talked about his American Sentences. I interviewed him with that book. One of my greatest interviewing regrets is not to ask him. I had the opportunity, but didn't really think much about them until Ann and Andrew brought them back to my attention. And so I started writing one a day in preparation for their workshop. And then, of course, I missed the workshop. And then the day song is as much as you can write in one day. A Time Before Slaughter, which then got appended with Pig War and Other Songs of Cascadia, based on an event in the San Juan Islands. That's long form, and that's not over yet. I'm still interested in investigating the culture of this bioregion, and I still have more in me to communicate. I'd love to be able to write chapters on Susan Point's work, the Musqueam artist, on Rick Bartow's work, on Jean Quictusee Smith, who has got a beautiful exhibit at Seattle Art Museum. So, I have a couple of poems. The Highborn are generally one page or just over one page, but they're very dense. If they had the mm-hmm. lineation of what I normally have, they would probably be 4, 5, or 6 pages. So you can look at it that way as well.
I know. I agree. And you've got some great elegies for Slaughter at the end of your long poem that are really dense, short lyrical bursts that I love. I think that it might actually help to set up the practice of the day song and some ideas that are embedded in them by going back to the spring of 2023 and taking up the first page of this day song. It's called Another Day Song, 1980. And if I could get you to read the first page, Paul, to set us up, and then skip to pages 8 through 11, if that's not too hard to keep track of, to get some key ideas that you return to in various pieces, such as those by Robert Duncan and Dogen.
You want the long epigraph quoting Gil Scott-Heron, or should I just go to the first page?
How about just the first line from that? Is that too?
Robot dignitaries better welcome you. Aliens applaud as you pass on review. Nourishment and encouragement for the captain and his crew includes a ticker tape parade down the main avenue, from Gil Scott-Heron and Brian Jackson, 1980, mm-hmm. 6:21 a.m. And there was Gil and Brian Jackson on XRT, and a kid from the Northwest Side starts his radio career pondering black astronauts and Abscam and U.S. American hostages in Iran and Abul Hassan Banisadr. And here's another Chicago man, knowing prophecy when he smelt it, robot overlords, algorithms, chat GPT. We can have our thinking pre-chewed for us, as if no teeth. And Gil as the Black Dylan, but with a good voice, and a politics at least as left as Zimmy. And Gil in 1980, just whetting my appetite for B-movie, the year from Shogun to Raygun. Here in the now, the robot overlords bought the second world and seemed to own the first. 43 years fly by in an eye flick, and I'd find Soma in a corner of Buckley above the fog, below the snow. It might have been Karen and Marcia on the 6 a.m. radio show on the physics of consciousness launched all this. The wounds are all in the body mind and allowing those to lift through deep tissue work. It released poetry trapped in that skinny Cuban guy since at least 1980.
Page 8.
We didn't know then what a neoliberal was. Well, we knew the symptoms, just had not braced for Ronald Reagan, for George H.W. Bush, for Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Al Gore, algorithms, PATCO, dismemberment. Robert Duncan knew, quote, hatred of all communal things, of communion, of communism. Duncan knew, quote, every present activity in the poem redistributes future as well as past events. So to understand the personal myth adjustments the day song makes, how intentionality'd have to wait, suffer 1980, be buoyed by Gill and think it could be done by the psychedelic furs. I'm American, ha, ha, ha. One week before this half-Cuban future interviewer kid had turned 19, Bill Evans had turned out the stars in, quote, the longest suicide in history, as Gene Lees is said to have put it, September 15. Listen to Blue in Green and see if there could ever be something in music with more duende. Blues in the heart chakra, integrating creative expression with compassion. Could be that Blue and Green from Kind of Blues, A Poet's Guide to Being Here as Long as Scott LaFaro's Nearby, or Then the Deal's Off. One long 1980 elegy we might have seen on the new channel debuted June 1, 1980, known as the Cable News Network.
Brilliant. And we're talking with Paul E. Nelson of Cascadia Poetics Lab fame, and he was just reading from his day song called Another Day Song, 1980. And, I really want to talk about some of these references, especially Bill Evans' Blue and Green. Probably, I would agree, the song that has the most duende than any that I can think of. So let's get into it and talk a little bit.
Well, Bill Evans was one of the best jazz pianists who ever lived and did not get the credit that he deserved for his contribution to Blue and Green. And it's a song that just tears your heart out. It tears my heart out. I have it on my memorial playlist, which is on Spotify, a playlist called Not Technically Blues. And it's just a stunning, stunning piece of music. Miles at his best, Bill Evans at his best, the whole band, a band of Hall of Fame geniuses, jazz geniuses, really. So how could you go wrong?
I agree with you. And for some reason, I listen to Bill Evans on a loop these days. I think I started listening to him when I was 19, going out with a Latino jazz producer in New York who helped Bill Evans through some of his hard times there. And we know that he had those hard times. And I've been, I'll probably put it on my list too, my playlist for the funeral. But let's go back to when we were 19, Paul. I guess I was 17 and you were 19. And you were talking at the beginning of this poem that you wrote, that you read a portion of, about being a skinny Cuban guy in 1980, living in Chicago, getting into radio. You're 19 years old, and you're learning a lot about things that were going to cause us a lot of blues later, including Ray Gunn and things that Gil Scott-Heron was writing about. The revolution will not be televised, though it might be actually created by robot overlords and then produced on television as though it's real. And you're making some parallels between technologies and tendencies from 1980 and their fruition today, when robot overlords, algorithms, ChatGPT, we can have our thinking pre-chewed for us as if no teeth. Your poetry has a lot of teeth, and this section has a lot of teeth. What were you thinking when opening this poem with so many juxtapositions between 1980 and the present, do you think?
Young lady came into the cafe I go to and had, she must have been in her 20s, maybe 30. And the hat said, Reagan ruined everything.
Isn't that the truth? Set us up.
Well, there's one, there's a lot of truth to it. Just one example, the overthrow of governments in Central America, turning those countries into, problems. Those countries have had serious problems since that era. And then people fleeing the violence come to this country, and then they're horrible people and we can't let them in, or we ship them to Martha's Vineyard or whatever. It's just, you know, I'm waiting. And because Joe Biden sort of tends toward the neoliberal, I'm waiting for someone to say, Republicans, you started this problem by your policies in Central America, and which Reagan famously testified. I don't remember. I can't recall how many, 83 times or whatever it was.
That was so, early Alzheimer's.
Yeah, it was. It was. And, you know, but the fact is that that was a covert activity. That was, you know, that's, oh, it's a war crime. Mining the harbors in Nicaragua was a war crime. And so there's much to look back at the beginning of this neoliberal era and say, that's where it started going wrong in many ways. Eviscerating the PATCO union, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Union, is an example of that. So with the knowledge that you have in 2023, looking back at 1980, you can see where some of those things that were maybe small then are gigantic or had gigantic effects on this country today. And I don't spare Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and Al Gore. I believe they're neoliberals also. And I love the fact that when I was walking in Santa Fe last week, I saw this bumper sticker near the campus of the University of New Mexico. This was in Albuquerque that said, we could have had Bernie twice, is what the sticker said. So, you know, so it's the benefit of looking at 1980 from a 2023 perspective and, you know, from a perspective of someone who is looking for justice in the world, in politics, in economics, in the environment, and in everything else. And that juxtaposition is just, you know, kind of my normal pattern. Bill or Philip Whalen said his poetry is a graph or map of his mind moving. And that's what I think projective verse is. And the key is to feed it, to feed the mind, the local mind, potent stuff so that it could come out in a way also that's potent and be a high energy construct.
It is a high energy construct, and it is zigzagging across temporal and spatial nodes, tying this, what Matt Treese says at the beginning in the introduction to Pig War, sort of taking a linear line and tying it into these knots, these nodes that come up again and again. One of which is a quote by Robert Duncan that you read. Hatred of all communal things, of communion, of communism. Duncan knew every present activity in the poem redistributes future as well as past events. So it kind of reminds me of Eliot's tradition and the individual talent, that as soon as you put a poem into the canon, it, everything adjusts around it. But you're talking about adjusting future events through present activity in the poem. So which kind of talks to your cosmological perspective in poetry, going back to what I was saying earlier about Levertov and a Levertovian kind of mystical presence that I feel in your poetry, that you are really believing that that poems can make a difference, that that as an extension of your mind, which you've called a verb, poems make things happen in the inner world, and that has a correspondence in the outer world. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And when Duncan, when I came across that Duncan quote in the process of writing the day song, I was like, holy cow, on the radio. It's not what I said, but you can fill in your favorite word.
Yeah, you're instead, a radio guy. You know,
instead of cow, I know. And that's why I love podcasting, because you can say whatever the heck you want.
And speaking of radio, got to have a station ID. I'm Roxy Power, speaking with Paul Nelson on KSQD FM 90.7 Santa Cruz for the Hive Poetry Collective. And please continue, Paul.
So when I saw that quote, I knew it was the fulcrum for the poem and for the whole experience. And in fact, today, sitting on the table in the hypnotherapy office, that quote flashed through my head, that you can go back in time and readjust your relationship to those events.
Ooh.
Powerful. And change things and change the future direction of your event. And Duncan knew that as an example of what we might call magic. And I think that what we call magic, or what a Wiccan priestess might call magic, is exactly that. Going back to the time when I was 9 years old and my dad was drunk and hit my mother and I couldn't do anything about it. And I felt like I wasn't good enough in that moment that I could learn to have some compassion for that 9-year-old boy and release him from the pain that he's felt since then. and know that the poem was doing its best to allow me to be fully present in this moment and letting go of the wounds of the past, having compassion for myself, also for my parents, but understanding that I was the best I could with the tools that I had at the time, as were my parents. So that's a little bit of what I would say when you talk about every present activity in the poem redistributes future as well as past events. So in this particular poem, Another Day Song, 1980, I was looking back at the skinny kid who was listening to psychedelic Furs and Jackson Browne and pop music like that, but then also realizing you were going to see Wayne Shorter with Weather Report at the Auditorium Theater. You were there seeing Steve Lacy with Mel Waldron at the Chicago Jazz Festival. So you, on some level, were Gary Burton and Chick Corea at Chicago Fest. Life-changing things. And again, world-class improvisers, Hall of Fame jazz geniuses, and on some part of me was tracking that. So build up the part of me that was tracking that and have some compassion for the kid who was listening to the psychedelic Furs and every now and then listen to India in the car and turn it up, you know, but more listening to Andy Shepherd and Carla Bley and, you know, any number of people that you could see who I listened to on Spotify.
Oh, I'm so thankful that you do share your Spotify list with me sometimes. And when Carla Bley died last year, I hadn't really been listening to her until you turned me on to her, for which I'm very grateful. And I loved going, seeing the documentary about Thelonious Monk in Seattle with you. I love that connection that we have. Spontaneous composition in jazz, in poetry, in life. I felt the first time you and I met, again, through this person in Seattle who said, you've got to know Paul because of organic poetry. I wrote you and I said, I'm going to be doing these events for the AWP in Seattle. Do you have any ideas? And immediately, because you're Mr. Seattle and Mr. Kind and Mr. Poetry, you collaborated with me in creating two amazing events and just you make things happen. So moving across the space of Seattle as you do, moving across the space of your life as you do, from being 19-year-old, getting into jazz and radio, and then talking about in your next day song being 62 and looking back on some of these years earlier, even elementary school with three friends that you lost when they were 62. All right. So this is, again, these day songs kind of compassing a really potent time. How about if we move to that day song before we get to your big poems at the end? Sure. Gabriela Gutierrez y Muz, who wrote the introduction for Day Song Miracle, past 62, she says that one enters the music of prayer and the prayer of music that is Paul Nelson's poetry. And I agree with her. When I think of your poetry and you in general, I think of music, as I just said, and certainly prayer. And she talks a lot about how the pen that you gave her oozes Buddhism. And so you're oozing Buddhism and jazz in this poem, two things that I think occupy a kind of temporality in a similar way, a kind of impermanence. You know, it's performance of something you don't even know you're going to do because you are not the solid self that you think you are. Creates surprises for you in that kinetic energy, which is what Olson was trying to get at, like the energy passed from wherever you got it all the way over to the listener can't be something that has been rehearsed necessarily, right? So there's so much to say about this poem, but I think we should just leap right into it. And if you could kindly read the first few pages of this, your newest book just about to be published, maybe through the first section between 5:26 a.m. and 7:48 a.m. How's that?
Fantastic. Thanks, Roxy. From Day Song Miracle, past 62, 5:26 a.m. Venus moves a little higher in the pre-dawn sky and the day song begins. There's $138.60 in checking and the parade of mufflerless cars begins. Another August has died, and September turns into a body count. She who can survive August, survive stage 4 cancer, can survive the needs of the Anthropocene, deserves our, if not veneration, at least humble respect. So, with spell check on and personal universe cards deployed and 56 days worth of postcards standing by, the Day Song seeks to put noospheric vision to work in the Buddha field, mining a collective unconscious to reveal what yoga and spiritual ecology and Zazen and Latihan Kejuan have so far hidden. May the Bodhidharma touch this keyboard and guide each emerging syllable. Festoon this fledgling September consciousness and the comets underneath. Poem as Day Song, as exploration of the cosmos from the south side of the Ribbon Lake's Casa del Colibri. Miracles disappear with Buddhas, but do not overwhelm Buddhas, says Dogen. And the miracle of projective verse, the miracle of the practice of outside, the miracle of organic form, the miracle of impersonal verse arise just as does September chicory awaiting the real rain, as do September rose hips fattening on the branch and the daughters, the successful endoscopy, and all the assorted minor miracles, cedar incense, ground altars, clean air, golden beets, sobriety in an age almost demands drunkenness. And all I have is coffee and syllables, line breaks and postcards, and friends dead at 62, with me a fortnight short of that apparently ignominious age. I met John in fourth grade, me, an expert on state capitals due to the puzzle in Miss Sauber's first and second grade classroom, where we were properly prepared to skip third grade. What is the capital of Alaska? You know, the pun John heard once and reran all through Miss McMahon's class. And Sox fans, that summer of 69, a fifth place year, a year of Don Gutteridge and Luis Aparicio, of Buddy Bradford and Joel Horlin and Tommy John before the famous surgery bears his name, of Bobby Knopp and Bob Locker, Bill Melton and Tommy McCraw, and knuckleballer Wilbur Wood. Who'd have any idea 53 years later John would be having hallucinations of being a hockey player at a Trump rally in the hospital with shit in his lungs, fighting esophageal cancer. And Apostolos Christovolos Paul, an U.S. American, studying his ass off to be a valedictorian, only to abandon ROTC for reefer at Lane Tech and maintain that a Greek immigrant could sing the Mississippi blues. Drachma on the party bus, CTA's Addison West 152 to Pueblo, who knew he'd marry someone whose limbs would start to drop off and this Asimov-like intelligence would make ends meet through heating and cooling. And last, Jim, who'd Facebook post his last day about to live and die in L.A., just to live in the burbs and die in bed? There has to be more than this, she'd say, and she'd be right. There are myriad miracles, according to Dogen, the miracles of renouncing resentment as the cancer closes in, the miracle of intimate language, whether postcards or during a now-welcomed Reiki treatment, miracles of clean air, September sunrises, rabid leaps, and Japanese water filter systems of Shikantaza and fair trade coffee and matcha and Susan's banana bread, of noospheric messages to a stage 4 mother who gives up smoking at 85 and is not happy about it, the miracles of walking mountains and floating bridges and shadow hermitage retreats and mountains named after mountains in Greece but with less ouzo, the miracle of day singing and ceremonial cedar incense and being the one who must carry memories because heaven favors the last survivor. It is you who must carry that Thursday night in Chicago, April 2, 1981, memory of Al Di Meola, Paco de Lucia, and John McLaughlin, alive, auditorium theater, accompanying the two guitarists at your side that night, to breathe the miracle of April lakefront air in the wake of one last Mediterranean sundance. Y Rio Ancho could be Cuba or Colombia, but in Paco's hands, a gypsy flamenco finger burn in the key of E minor, then A minor, D, G, C, and B7. Insurance a much better capitalist bet than guitar for a life in Park Ridge and daughters who disowned him and to whom he would give nothing but the capital of Alaska, Juneau.
This one starts at 5:26 a.m. and it's a pre-dawn sky. The day song begins. We already have your kind of discipline that you bring into the day song in place there. Another August has died and September turns into a body count. You said a few things about how elegiacal you feel this time of year is, and your birthday happens to be around then. I just want to say I'm really sorry about your friends. Three of them, three good friends, all dying at the age of 62. You're still 62. You're still going. It's going to happen. You're going to be fine, Paul. You have to be that witness that you talk about at the end, looking back, painful as it is. At another moment in this poem, you talk about the day song being as bitter and sweet as a blackberry. So there's a lot of sweetness here. And the bitterness is not here so much as it's just kind of a duende of around loss. Your mom is surviving stage 4 cancer, and you tie her to a bigger picture, right? Who can survive stage 4 cancer can survive the needs of the Anthropocene, a very Paul move going small and large, those luminous, minute details to the bigger picture. And then you have your spiritual evocation of muses, often brought out through something that has to do with Michael McClure, of course, the personal universe cards. And you're trying to put a cosmic gloss on things, a noospheric vision. We need a glossary to read your poems. I guess noosphere is the highest stage of biospheric development in human reasoning. The thought that human thought will create the next geological layer. And then you talk about your practice of yoga, Zazen, and Latihan Kejuan, something you've been doing for many years, an Indonesian practice that what opens to your own inner awakening in a group setting.
Yeah, men separate from women. And an organization started in Indonesia, and the Latihan is a very spontaneous practice of purification, or I like to use Gary Snyder's phrase, which wasn't about Latihan, but could be applied to it. It's a cleansing of the mechanism of perception, something to that effect.
Ooh. Well, part of the cleansing of the mechanism of perception that you come back to again and again is counting miracles now that you're practicing Zen. And in a way, I see you talking about the virtues of the impersonal through Olson's projective verse, that, you know, verse so far has been, what is it, any private voice wailing at any public wall? No,
the, not wailing. The private soul in any public wall.
Right. And I think that one of my challenges is when I get pretty personal in my poem, how to make it not just impersonal, but, you know, related to some bigger contexts, at least. And you do that very well. A very palm move, moving between, again, the outside and the inside, the September chicory awaiting the real rain, as do September rose hips. I love those rose hips fattening on the branch, and they come back later with the rabbit. And, you know, juxtaposing that with the successful endoscopy. Like, who does that? Rose hips and endoscopy. Endoscopy is really looking on the inside, literally. It's like a Poundian ideogram. We're taking this class right now through your Cascadia Poetics Lab on Ezra Pound with Andrew Schelling, and we're talking about ideograms, an image of the correspondence between inner and outer worlds. That comes up a lot in your poetry, I would say. And one of those themes, I think, is how gratitude is a counterpoint to resentment, which leads to disease. The power of the mind, again, the cosmic dimension of poetry.
Well, that comes directly out of being diagnosed with chronic lymphocytic leukemia and having a grandmother who died in her 50s from leukemia, and using the work of Louise Hay, who in Heal Your Body gave us a very nice opposite pole from allopathic medicine. For those who believe that the mind and the body are connected, one can look to Louise Hay to see what certain diseases or problems with certain body parts mm-hmm. could be sourced in, the psychic pattern, the thought patterns could be sourced in that. And so leukemia, what's the use, as I recall, and it says, look to blood disorders, and the blood disorders say a lack of joy, lack of circulation of ideas. So then talking before Latihan to a now late Subud brother, Evan Padilla, he said, well, Paul, I think the foundation of joy is gratitude. And that immediately upon hearing that, understanding that to be true, understanding that to be my problem was I had the same joy as other people, but I chose to magnify the stuff that gave me angst, including many people ahead of me in traffic. So I think that when we could make those shifts in our lives, and you know, I turned it into a practice, it's almost like a spontaneous poem. When I wake up and I take my thyroid medicine and my vitamins and my liver cleansing pills and that kind of stuff, the milk thistle and the dandelion root and the burdock, I just say, I give thanks for being alive today. I give thanks to be with this woman. I give thanks to have this, for having this view. I give thanks for the work I do. I give thanks for my health. And, you know, it can be like a projective poem where it leads on and on. I give thanks for that successful endoscopy or whatever the train of thought leads you to. But as long as you're giving thanks for it. And I think after a while, we can get to the point where we're real Zazen practitioners, real Buddhists, and give thanks for everything that happens to us. And yes. Be like Japanese during World War II. And even though they were losing all their possessions and being taken to prisons, their mantra was, "Dekita koto wa shikata ga nai." What has been done can't be helped. And that's an attitude I aspire to. And of course, I manifested as Soto Zen teacher a couple of years ago, and my life hasn't been the same since then.
Well, you know, that's a really good segue. I've been wanting to get us to In a Time Before Slaughter, and you do write a poem in there called Shikata Nagai. And, you know, this poem, readers can this book, Daesung Miracle, Past 62, will be fresh out from Carbonation Press soon by the inimitable Greg Bem, who just started this great press. Great section on gratitude, miracles according to Dogen, the miracles of renouncing resentment as the cancer closes in, the miracles of intimate language. We could say so much about the intimate language of your poetry, whether postcards, which to me are very public language, and like Ray Johnson sending out postcards anonymously to the world. Miracles of clean air, rabbit leaps, filter systems. There's all these things that we take for granted. So let's try to talk a little bit about one of your older poems that's so important for readers to know about, A Time Before Slaughter, which was first published about 12 or 13 years ago, and then again collected in a second edition along with Pig War. So two very long investigative poems about Cascadia that rely on incredible history gathering research and then putting it into a poem that takes us all over the place. You know, obviously we want to talk about General Slaughter and the dominism and the colonialism that he and others are associated with, and the town that you spent many years in after you left Chicago. But since you brought up Shikata Ganai, let's move to that, because that's one of the stories that you talk about in it's a good thing I just happened to open to it. Believe it or not, it's on page 62. And I think that's auspicious. 62. Not past 62, but 62.
Right at 62. Shall I read that poem?
Please, Paul. Thank you.
It's an acrostic. So I wrote the word Dikita Koto wa shikata ga nai down the left margin and then filled it in. And it came out like this: slaughter shikata ga nai, dominism in action. Try to eke out a living near Shirakawa, busting stumps, working, working, hands bleeding in slaughter where the cherry trees in May still blossom and the stuck still flows toward Kumamoto Prefecture, where the old ones say, Dikita koto wa shikata ga nai. That is, what has been done cannot be helped. 1 century of what's been done can't be helped. All the unmistakable signs of slaughter, perennial adolescent, he of alien land law and internment of World War II. He might be Kent's representative James Jones, or Miller Freeman of the Anti-Japanese League, or a prosecutor named Malcolm Douglas, terror of peaceful Nisei farmers and reason. The gentleman's agreement is dropped, and the slaughter continues with no respite, exclusion laws, gunpoint stick-ups, and worst of all, when no other recourse, immolation. Slaughter shikata ga nai.
Oof. Well, you have some very wise voices in a time before slaughter and a time after slaughter. The Japanese in the internment camp give us a map for how to deal with dominism, a word that you refer to frequently in this book. Do you want to talk about how the internment camps and the figures, such as, you don't really have time to write, read, I don't think, about Frank, Elegy for Frank, but Frank Natsuhara.
Natsuhara. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And yeah. Well, I bought a walk from him.
You bought a walk from Frank.
I bought a walk from Frank. I knew who he was and I knew what the story was and went into that one time and bought a walk. And that was my only exchange with him. And then when he died, I wrote that poem, which probably, Elegy for Frank, which probably was really the first, it may be the oldest poem in the book, but it doesn't come first in the order.
Well, then let's read it, because you, when the dripping that comes out of the McClurism there. So it's a gorgeous reading. We should just hear you read it because of your gorgeous speaking voice. Anyway, go for it.
Thanks, Roxy. And I'll just say there's an African proverb that says when an elder dies, it's like a library burns to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Elegy for Frank. The train stopped in slaughter one more time last week. Frank Natsuhara, punched ticket, memory in Doppler rhythm and train horns of one last goodbye. Another library, now valley lone. How did they save the store? How did it feel, prisoner of race? How the barbed wire, humiliation. Oh, Frank Natsuhara, how will they remember you in this, your home, this big valley? Plum petals sailing in a spring gust, juice from strawberry dripping from chin.
There's so much empathy in this poem. How did they save the store? How did it feel, prisoner of race? How the barbed wire, humiliation. Oh, Frank Natsuhara, how will they remember you in this, your home? But to tease our readers, and I'm just going to ask you to choose from part one what you want to read.
The time before slaughter, one. Slaughter is a man, Lieutenant William Alloway Slaughter, a dependable man, energetic officer, a crack shot with a rifle. Slaughter's a town founded by Levi Ballard. He plotted slaughter, settled first by Midwesterners from Illinois and Wisconsin. Slaughter is a notion, an idea. Process infected full with a dominator virus, what infects to this day? SUV or Ram Charger, tailgating driver with stoic face. Slaughter's the sunset, apricot over West Hill, perennial, and the sky wide and complex. Slaughter is Stellar Jay's loud return in March in memory of Chief Canasket. November 25, 1855, there is no memorial here for him. Slaughter is a baptism in the Christian tradition of total sobriety, a warning about the changers and loss of the land. Slaughter is vapor trails. What head toward Grace Steeple as fog enshrouds West Hill April. Slaughter in May, a blizzard of cherry blossoms with each stiff wind in their pirouette in the wake of a speeding car. Slaughter is Indian Tom and Moonlight Rescue of Johnny King, October 28, 1855, by canoe down the Green to the Duwamish until safe with Marines on the sloop of war Decatur and soon Wisconsin. Slaughter's the sound of freight train horns to the west. Somewhere under the crescent moon, Nootka roses wide open this side of the June stuck. Slaughter is July heron, landing in the river or standing tall, hunting fish. Slaughter is the rush of stuck through rocks on a rainy August Friday. Slaughter is the rush of stuck through rocks on a rainy August Friday. Slaughter is the rush of stuck through rocks on a rainy August. Rainy August. Rainy August Friday. Friday. Friday.
There was our unstucking of the Stuck River, which has been violently unstuck in the past. So if you had 1 minute to summarize it, what the gist of the story is about these rivers, this man named Slaughter, and how it intersects with your history, what might that be? Is that a possibility?
Don't try to control things.
Right. Don't try to control things like interviews. Yeah, there's a great poem in here called Dominism that one day we'll get you to read. Thank God that the term showed up in the poem before last, because I do think that is your major ethical message. Don't try to control things. All of your spiritual practices lead toward that too. And Paul, do you want to say a quick word about your big project that you're working on right now? There's always a big one, but it's about a writing center, right? And
Hagia Ni is envisioned as a writer's retreat center on the Olympic Peninsula. We mm-hmm. want to especially make sure that Black, Indigenous, and poets of color have a chance to experience real wilderness, the real wilderness of Cascadia. Our budget right now is $4.4 million to make this happen. It would also be a backpacker hostel as its side hack. And anyone who wants to help with that, we would love to have them. Kagyan Ni means Shadow Hermitage number 2, and it's an homage to Sam Hamill, whose house he built by his hands in Port Townsend, Washington. It was called Kagyan, or Shadow Hermitage. So It's an homage to Sam. All my work is an homage to the people who've gone before me, who were kind to me and showed me the way. Michael McClure, Joanne Kiger, Wanda Coleman, those who are still around, Nate Mackey, Brenda Hillman, George Bowring, Sharon Thiessen, Daphne Marlett, and many, many, many others. And Roxy, your sacred preparation and conduction of this interview is a real blessing, and I thank you for that.
There's no way to compass a man like you in 1 hour, Paul, so I will welcome you back again, but speaking of gratitude, very thankful for this opportunity to talk with you today. Many blessings to you.
Stay well.
Thank you. I'm Roxy Power, and this is the Hive Poetry Collective, and we've been talking with Paul E. Nelson on KSQD 90.7 FM.